Chapter 5. Emil J. Freireich. How Jay did it, I don't know. 1. When Jay Freireich was very young, his father died suddenly. The Freirichs were Hungarian immigrants who were running a restaurant in Chicago. It was just after the stock market crash in 1929. They lost everything. They found him in the bathroom, Freireich said. I think it was suicide, because he felt all alone. He'd come to Chicago because he had a brother there. When the crash occurred, the brother left town. He had a wife, two small children, no money, a restaurant gone. He must have been pretty desperate. Freireich's mother went to work in a sweatshop, sewing rims on hats. She made 2 cents a hat. She didn't speak much English. She had to work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make enough money to have an apartment for us to rent, Freireich went on. We never saw her. We had a little apartment on the west side of Humboldt Park, bordering the ghetto. She couldn't leave a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old all alone, so she found an immigrant Irish lady who worked for room and board. My parent, from the age of 2, was this Irish maid. We loved her. She was my mother. Then, when I was 9, my mother met a Hungarian man who had lost his wife and had 1 son, and she married him. It was a marriage of convenience. He couldn't take care of the son by himself, and she didn't have anybody. He was a really bitter, shriveled guy. So they got married, and my mother left the sweatshop and appeared back on the scene, and they couldn't afford the maid anymore. So they fired her. They fired my mother. I never forgave my mother for that. The family moved from one apartment to another. They had protein 1 day a week. Freireich remembers being sent from store to store looking for a bottle of milk for 4 cents, because the normal price of 5 cents was more than the family could afford. He spent his days on the street. He stole. He wasn't close to his sister. She was more disciplinarian than friend. He didn't like his stepfather. In any case, the marriage didn't last. He didn't like his mother either. Whatever mind she had was destroyed in the sweatshops, he said. She was an angry person. And when she married this ugly guy who brought this person in, my half-brother, who got half of everything I used to get, and then she fired my mother? His voice trailed off. Freireich was sitting at his desk. He was wearing a white coat. Everything he was talking about was both long ago and, in another, more important sense, not long ago at all. I can't remember her ever hugging or kissing me or anything like that, he said. She never talked about my father. I have no idea whether he was nice to her or mean. I never heard a word. Do I ever think about what he might have been like? All the time. I have one picture. Freireich turned in his chair and clicked on a file of pictures on his computer. Up came a grainy early 20th century photograph of a man who, not surprisingly, looked a lot like Freireich himself. That's the only picture of him my mother ever had, he said. The edges of the photo were uneven. It had been cropped from a much larger family photograph. I asked about the Irish maid who raised him. What was her name? He stopped short, a rare pause for him. I don't know, he said. It will pop into my head, I'm sure. He sat still for a moment and concentrated. My sister would remember. My mother would remember. But they're no longer alive. I have no living relatives, just 2 cousins. He paused again. I want to call her Mary, and that may actually be her name. But my mother's name was Mary, so I may be confusing it. Freireich was 84 years old when we talked, but it would be a mistake to call this an age-related memory lapse. Jay Freireich does not have memory lapses. I interviewed him for the first time one spring, and then again 6 months later, and again after that, and every time he would recall dates and names and facts with clock-like precision. And if he went over the same ground as he had on some previous occasion, he would stop himself and say, "I know I said this to you before." He could not retrieve the name of the woman who raised him because everything from those years was so painful that it had been pushed to the furthest recesses of his mind. 2. In the years leading up to the Second World War, the British government was worried. If, in the event of war, the German Air Force launched a major air offensive against London, the British military command believed that there was nothing they could do to stop it. Basil Liddell Hart, one of the foremost military theorists of the day, estimated that in the first week of any German attack, London could see 250,000 civilian deaths and injuries. Winston Churchill described London as the greatest target in the world, a kind of tremendous, fat, valuable cow tied up to attract the beast of prey. He predicted that the city would be so helpless in the face of attack that between 3 and 4 million Londoners would flee to the countryside. In 1937, on the eve of the war, the British military command issued a report with the direst prediction of all. A sustained German bombing attack would leave 600,000 dead and 1.2 million wounded and create mass panic in the streets. People would refuse to go to work. Industrial production would grind to a halt. The army would be useless against the Germans because it would be preoccupied with keeping order among the millions of panicked civilians. The country's planners briefly considered building a massive network of underground bomb shelters across London, but they abandoned the plan out of a fear that if they did, the people who took refuge there would never come out. They set up several psychiatric hospitals just outside the city's limit to handle what they expected would be a flood of psychological casualties. "There is every chance," the report stated, "that this could cost us the war." In the fall of 1940, the much-anticipated attack began. Over a period of 8 months, beginning with 57 consecutive nights of devastating bombardment, German bombers thundered across the skies above London, dropping tens of thousands of high-explosive bombs and more than 1 million incendiary devices. 40,000 people were killed, and another 46,000 were injured. 1 million buildings were damaged or destroyed. In the city's east end, entire neighborhoods were laid to waste. It was everything the British government officials had feared, except that every one of their predictions about how Londoners would react turned out to be wrong. The panic never came. The psychiatric hospitals built on the outskirts of London were switched over to military use because no one showed up. Many women and children were evacuated to the countryside as the bombing started, but people who needed to stay in the city, by and large, stayed. As the Blitz continued, as the German assaults grew heavier and heavier, the British authorities began to observe, to their astonishment, not just courage in the face of the bombing, but something closer to indifference. In October 1940, I had occasion to drive through southeast London just after a series of attacks on that district, one English psychiatrist wrote just after the war ended. Every 100 yards or so, it seemed, there was a bomb crater or wreckage of what had once been a house or shop. The siren blew its warning, and I looked to see what would happen. A nun seized the hand of a child she was escorting and hurried on. She and I seemed to be the only ones who heard the warning. Small boys continued to play all over the pavements. Shoppers went on haggling. A policeman directed traffic in majestic boredom, and the cyclists defied death and the traffic laws. No one, so far as I could see, even looked into the sky. I think you'll agree, this is hard to believe. The Blitz was war. The exploding bombs sent deadly shrapnel flying in every direction. The incendiaries left a different neighborhood in flames every night. More than 1 million people lost their homes. Thousands crammed into makeshift shelters and subway stations every night. Outside, between the thunder of planes overhead, the thud of explosions, the rattle of anti-aircraft guns, and the endless wails of ambulances, fire stations, and warning sirens, the noise was unrelenting. In one survey of Londoners on the night of September 12, 1940, a third said they had gotten no sleep the night before, and another third said they had got fewer than 4 hours. Can you imagine how New Yorkers would have reacted if one of their office towers had been reduced to rubble? Not just once, but every night for 2.5 months? The typical explanation for the reaction of Londoners is the British stiff upper lip, the stoicism said to be inherent in the English character. Not surprisingly, this is the explanation most favored by the British themselves. But one of the things that soon became clear was that it wasn't just the British who behaved this way. Civilians from other countries also turned out to be unexpectedly resilient in the face of bombing. Bombing, it became clear, didn't have the effect that everyone thought it would have. It was a puzzle. During the war, one theory after another was put forth in explanation, the most influential of which came from the Canadian psychiatrist J.T. McCurdy. McCurdy argued that when a bomb falls, it divides the affected population into three groups. The first group is the people killed. They are the ones for whom the experience of the bombing is, obviously, the most devastating. But as McCurdy points out, perhaps a bit callously, the morale of the community depends on the reaction of the survivors, so from that point of view, the killed do not matter. Put this way, the fact is obvious. Corpses do not run about spreading panic. The next group he called the near misses. They feel the blast, they see the destruction, are horrified by the carnage, perhaps they are wounded, but they survive deeply impressed. Impression means here a powerful reinforcement of the fear reaction in association with bombing. It may result in shock, a loose term that covers anything from a dazed state or actual stupor to jumpiness and preoccupation with the horrors that have been witnessed. Third, he said, are the remote misses. These are the people who listen to the sirens, watch the enemy bombers overhead, and hear the thunder of the exploding bombs. But the bomb hits down the street, or the next block over, and for them, the consequences of a bombing attack are exactly the opposite of the near-miss group. They survived, and the second or third time that happens, the emotion associated with the attack, McCurdy wrote, is a feeling of excitement with a flavor of invulnerability. A near miss leaves you traumatized. A remote miss makes you think you are invincible. In diaries and recollections of Londoners who lived through the Blitz, there are countless examples of this phenomenon. Here is one. When the first siren sounded, I took my children to our dugout in the garden, and I was quite certain we were all going to be killed. Then the all-clear went without anything having happened. Ever since we came out of the dugout, I have felt sure that nothing would ever hurt us. Or consider this from the diary of a young woman whose house was shaken by a nearby explosion. I lay there feeling indescribably happy and triumphant. I've been bombed, I kept saying to myself, over and over again, trying the phrase on like a new dress to see how it fitted. I've been bombed. I've been bombed. Me. It seems a terrible thing to say when many people were killed and injured last night, but never in my whole life have I ever experienced such pure and flawless happiness. So why were Londoners so unfazed by the Blitz? Because 40,000 deaths and 46,000 injuries spread across a metropolitan area of more than 8 million people means that there were many more remote misses who were emboldened by the experience of being bombed than there were near misses who were traumatized by it. We are all of us not merely liable to fear, McCurdy went on. We are also prone to be afraid of being afraid, and the conquering of fear produces acceleration. When we have been afraid that we may panic in an air raid, and when it has happened, we have exhibited to others nothing but a calm exterior, and we are now safe, the contrast between the previous apprehension and the present relief and feeling of security promotes a self-confidence that is the very father and mother of courage. In the midst of the Blitz, a middle-aged laborer in a button factory was asked if he wanted to be evacuated to the countryside. He had been bombed out of his house twice, but each time he and his wife had been fine. He refused. What? And miss all this? He exclaimed. Not for all the gold in China. There's never been nothing like it. Never, and never will be again. 3. The idea of desirable difficulty suggests that not all difficulties are negative. Being a poor reader is a real obstacle, unless you are David Boies, and that obstacle turns you into an extraordinary listener, or unless you are Gary Cohn, and that obstacle gives you the courage to take chances you would otherwise never have taken. McCurdy's theory of morale is a second, broader perspective on this same idea. The reason Winston Churchill and the English military brass were so apprehensive about the German attacks on London was that they assumed that a traumatic experience like being bombed would have the same effect on everyone. That the only difference between near misses and remote misses would be the degree of trauma they suffered. But to McCurdy, the Blitz proved that traumatic experiences can have two completely different effects on people. The same event can be profoundly damaging to one group while leaving another better off. That man who worked in a button factory and that young woman whose house was shaken by the bomb were better off for their experience, weren't they? They were in the middle of a war. They couldn't change that fact, but they were freed of the kinds of fears that can make life during wartime unendurable. Dyslexia is a classic example of the same phenomenon. Many people with dyslexia don't manage to compensate for their disability. There are a remarkable number of dyslexics in prison, for example. These are people who have been overwhelmed by their failure at mastering the most basic of academic tasks. Yet this same neurological disorder in people like Gary Cohn and David Boies can also have the opposite effect. Dyslexia blew a hole in Cohn's life, leaving a trail of misery and anxiety. But he was very bright, and he had a supportive family, and more than a little luck, and enough other resources that he was able to weather the worst effects of the blast and emerge stronger. Too often, we make the same mistake as the British did and jump to the conclusion that there is only one kind of response to something terrible and traumatic. There isn't. There are two. Which brings us back to Jay Freireich and the childhood he could not allow himself to remember. 4. When Jay Freireich was 9 years old, he contracted tonsillitis. He was very sick. The local physician, Dr. Rosenblum, came to his family's apartment to remove his inflamed tonsils. "I never saw a man in those years," Freireich said. "Everyone I knew was a woman. If you saw a man, he was dirty and in overalls. But Rosenblum, he had a suit and tie and he was dignified and kind. So from the age of 10, I used to dream about becoming a famous doctor. I never thought of any other career." In high school, his physics teacher took a shine to him and told him he should go to college. "I said, what do I need?" He said, "Well, probably if you get $25, I think you can make it." It was 1942. Things were better, but people still weren't very well off. $25 wasn't small stuff. I don't think my mother had ever seen $25. She said, "Well, let me see what I can do." A couple days later, she appeared. She'd found a Hungarian lady whose husband died and left her money, and believe it or not, she gave my mother $25. Instead of keeping it, my mother gave it to me. So here I am. I'm 16 years old, and I'm very optimistic. Freireich took the train from Chicago to Champaign-Urbana, where the University of Illinois was located. He rented a bedroom in a rooming house. He got a job waiting tables in a sorority house to pay his tuition, with the added bonus that he could feed himself from the leftovers. He did well and was accepted to medical school, after which he began his internship at Cook County Hospital, the major public hospital in Chicago. Medicine in those years was a genteel profession. Doctors held a privileged social position and typically came from upper-middle-class backgrounds. Freireich was not like that. At one point, he dated a woman from a much more affluent family than his. She was refined and sophisticated. Freireich was a bruiser from humble Park who looked and sounded like the muscle for some Depression-era gangster. "She took me to the symphony. It was the first time I'd ever heard classical music," he remembered. "I'd never seen a ballet. I'd never seen a play. Outside of our little TV that my mother purchased, I had no education to speak of. There was no literature, no art, no music, no dance, no nothing. It was just food and not getting killed or beaten up. I was pretty raw." Freireich was a research associate in hematology in Boston. From there, he was drafted into the Army and chose to complete his military service at the National Cancer Institute, just outside Washington, D.C. He was, by all accounts, a brilliant and dedicated physician, the first at the hospital in the morning and the last to leave. But he remained never more than a step away from his tumultuous beginnings. He had a volcanic temper. He had no patience, no gentleness. Even today, in his 80s, Farrakh is an intimidating man, 6'4" and thick through the chest and shoulders. His head is oversized, even for a body as large as his, making him seem bigger still. He's a talker, fluent and relentless and loud, his voice inflected with the hard vowels of his native Chicago. In moments of special emphasis, he has the habit of shouting and pounding the table with his fist, which, memorably, once resulted in his shattering a glass conference table. The immediate aftermath was later described as the only time anyone had ever seen Frerich silenced. One colleague remembers his unforgettable first impression of Frerich, a giant in the back of the room, yelling and screaming on the phone. Another remembers him as completely irrepressible. He would say whatever came into his mind. Over the course of his career, he would end up being fired 7 times. The first time during his residency, when he angrily defied the head nurse at Presbyterian Hospital in Chicago. One of his former co-workers remembers Frerich coming across a routine error made by one of his medical residents. A laboratory finding had been overlooked. "The patient died," the doctor said. "It wasn't because of the error. The error wasn't significant, but Jay screamed at him right there in the ward in front of 5 or 6 doctors and nurses. He called him a murderer, and the guy broke down and cried." Almost everything said about Frerich by his friends contains a but. "I love him, but," we nearly came to blows. "I invited him to my house, but he insulted my wife." "Frerich remains to this day one of my closest friends," said Evan Hirsch, an oncologist who worked with Frerich at the beginning of his career. "We take him to our weddings and bar mitzvahs. I love him like he is a father, but he was a tiger in those days. We had several terrible run-ins. There were times I wouldn't speak to him for weeks." Is it at all surprising that Frerich would be this way? The reason most of us do not scream "murderer" at our co-workers is that we can put ourselves in their shoes. We can imagine what someone else is feeling and create that feeling in ourselves. We can take that route because we have been supported and comforted and understood in our suffering. That support gives us a model of how to feel for others. It is the basis for empathy. But in Frerich's formative years, every human connection ended in death and abandonment. And a childhood as bleak as that leaves only pain and anger in its wake. Once, in the middle of reminiscing about his career, Frerich burst into an attack on the idea that terminally ill cancer patients be given hospice care at the end of their lives. "You have all these doctors who want to do hospice care. I mean, how can you treat a person like that?" When Frerich gets worked up about something, he raises his voice and his jaw sets. "Do you say, you've got cancer, you're certainly going to die, you've got pain and it's horrible, I'm going to send you to a place where you can die pleasantly? I would never say that to a person. I would say, you're suffering, you've got pain, I'm going to relieve your suffering. Are you going to die? Maybe not. I see miracles every day." There's no possibility of being pessimistic when people are dependent on you for their only optimism. On Tuesday morning, I make teaching rounds, and sometimes the medical fellows say, "This patient is 80 years old, it's hopeless." Absolutely not. It's challenging, it's not hopeless. You have to come up with something. You have to figure out a way to help them, because people must have hope to live. He was nearly shouting now. "I was never depressed. I never sat with a parent and cried about a child dying. That's nothing I would ever do in my role as a doctor. As a parent, I might do it. My kids died, I'd go crazy. But as a doctor, you swear to give people hope. That's your job." Frerich continued on in this vein for several more minutes until the full force of his personality became nearly overwhelming. We all want a physician who doesn't give up and who doesn't lose hope. But we also want a physician who can stand in our shoes and understand what we are feeling. We want to be treated with dignity. And treating people with dignity requires empathy. Could Frerich do that? "I was never depressed. I never sat with a parent and cried about a child dying." If we were asked if we would wish a childhood like Frerich's on anyone, we would almost certainly say no, because we could not imagine that any good could come of it. You can't have a remote miss from that kind of upbringing. What can you? 5. In the early 1960s, a psychologist named Marvin Eisenstadt started a project interviewing creatives, innovators and artists and entrepreneurs, looking for patterns and trends. As he was analyzing the responses, he noticed an odd fact. A surprising number had lost a parent in childhood. The group he was studying was so small that Eisenstadt knew there was a possibility that what he was seeing was just chance. But the fact nagged at him. What if it wasn't chance? What if it meant something? There had been hints in the psychological literature up to that point. In the 1950s, while studying a sample of famous biologists, the science historian Anne Rowe had remarked in passing on how many had at least one parent who died while they were young. The same observation was made a few years later in an informal survey of famous poets and writers like Keats, Wordsworth, Coleridge, Swift, Edward Gibbon, and Thackeray. More than half, it turned out, had lost a father or mother before the age of 15. The link between career achievement and childhood bereavement was one of those stray facts that no one knew what to do with. So Eisenstadt decided to embark on a more ambitious project. It was 1963-1964, Eisenstadt remembers. I started with the Encyclopedia Britannica, and then it turned into both Britannica and the Encyclopedia Americana. Eisenstadt made a list of every person, from Homer to John F. Kennedy, whose life merited more than one column in either encyclopedia. That, he felt, was a rough proxy for achievement. That gave him a list of 699 people. He then began systematically tracking down biographical information for everyone on the list. It took me 10 years, Eisenstadt said. I was reading all kinds of foreign language books. I went to California and to the Library of Congress and to the Genealogical Library in New York City. I tracked down as many parental loss profiles as I could until I felt I had good statistical results. Of the 573 eminent people for whom Eisenstadt could find reliable biographical information, a quarter had lost at least one parent before the age of 10. By age 15, 34.5% had at least one parent die, and by the age of 20, 45%. Even for the years before the 20th century, when life expectancy due to illness and accidents and warfare was much lower than it is today, those are astonishing numbers. At the same time as Eisenstadt was pursuing his research, the historian Lucile Iremonger set out to write a history of England's prime ministers. Her focus was on the period from the beginning of the 19th century to the start of the Second World War. What kinds of backgrounds and qualities, she wondered, predicted the kind of person capable of rising to the top of British politics at a time when it was the most powerful country in the world? Like Eisenstadt, however, she got sidetracked by a fact that, as she wrote, occurred so frequently that I began to wonder whether it was not of more than passing significance. 67% of the prime ministers in her sample lost a parent before the age of 16. That's roughly twice the rate of parental loss during the same period for members of the British upper class, the socioeconomic segment from which most prime ministers came. The same pattern can be found among American presidents. 12 of the first 44 U.S. presidents, beginning with George Washington and going all the way up to Barack Obama, lost their father while they were young. Since then, the topic of difficult childhoods and parental loss has cropped up again and again in the scholarly literature. There is a fascinating passage in an essay by the psychologist Dean Simonton, for example, in which he tries to understand why so many gifted children fail to live up to their early promise. One of the reasons, he concludes, is that they have inherited an excessive amount of psychological health. Those who fall short, he says, are children too conventional, too obedient, too unimaginative to make the big time with some revolutionary idea. He goes on, gifted children and child prodigies seem most likely to emerge in highly supportive family conditions. In contrast, geniuses have a perverse tendency of growing up in more adverse conditions. I realize these studies make it sound as if losing a parent is a good thing, People always kid me and say, oh, you mean I'd be better off if I don't have parents or if I murder my father? Eisenstadt said. The idea that some people could be successful without parents is a very threatening concept because the common idea is that parents help you. Parents are essential to your life. And that, Eisenstadt stresses, is absolutely true. Parents are essential. Losing a father or a mother is the most devastating thing that can happen to a child. The psychiatrist Felix Braun has found that prisoners are somewhere between 2 and 3 times more likely to have lost a parent in childhood than is the population as a whole. That's too great a difference to be a coincidence. There are, clearly, an enormous number of direct hits from the absence of a parent. The evidence produced by Eisenstadt, Ironmonger, and the others, however, suggests that there is also such a thing as a remote miss from the death of a parent. Your father can commit suicide and you can suffer from a childhood so unspeakable that you push it to the furthest corners of your memory, and still some good can end up coming from that. This is not an argument in favor of orphanhood and deprivation, Braun writes, but the existence of these eminent orphans does suggest that in certain circumstances, a virtue can be made of necessity. 6. When Jay Frarich arrived at the National Cancer Institute in 1955, he reported to Gordon Zubrod, the head of cancer treatment. Zubrod assigned him to the Children's Leukemia Ward on the second floor of the main hospital building in the center of campus. Childhood leukemia was then one of the most terrifying of all cancers. It struck without warning. A child as young as 1 or 2 would come down with a fever. The fever would persist. The child would come down with a violent headache that would not let up, followed by infections one after another as the child's body lost its ability to defend itself. Then came the bleeding. Dr. Zubrod came around once a week to see how we were doing, Frarich remembers, and he said to me, Frarich, this place is like an abattoir. There's blood all over the goddamn place. We have to clean it up. It was true. The kids bled from everywhere, through their stool, urine, that's the worst part. They paint the ceiling. They bleed from out of their ears, from their skin. There was blood on everything. The nurses would come to work in the morning in their white uniforms and go home covered in blood. The children would bleed internally into their liver and spleen, putting them in extraordinary pain. They would turn over in their bed and get terrible bruises. Even a nosebleed was a potentially fatal event. You'd squeeze the child's nose and put ice on it. That wouldn't work. You'd pack gauze into the child's nostrils. That wouldn't work. You'd call in an ear, nose, and throat specialist who would go in through the mouth and pack the nasal passage from behind with gauze, which then had to be pulled forward into the nose. The idea was to apply pressure on the blood vessels from inside the nasal cavity. You can imagine how painful that was for the child. Plus, it rarely worked, so you'd take out the gauze and the bleeding would start all over again. The goal of the second floor was to find a cure for leukemia, but the problem was that controlling the bleeding was so difficult that most of the children were dead before anyone could figure out how to help them. When they came to the hospital, 90% of the kids would be dead in 6 weeks, Frarich said. They would bleed to death. If you're bleeding in your mouth and your nose, then you can't eat. You stop eating. You try to drink. You gag, you vomit. You get diarrhea from the blood in the stools, so you starve to death. Or you get an infection, and then you get pneumonia, then you get fever, then you get convulsions, and then... He let his voice trail off. Doctors did not last long on the leukemia floor. It was too much. You got there at 7 in the morning, one physician who worked on the second floor in those years remembers. You left at 9 at night. You had to do everything. I would come home every day, completely destroyed psychologically. I became a stamp collector. I would sit down at 10 o'clock at night with my stamps, because it was the only way to take my mind off work. The parents were afraid. Nobody would even go into the children's room. They would stand at the door. Nobody wanted to work there. I had 70 kids who died on me that year. It was a nightmare. Not for Frarich. I was never depressed. I never sat with a parent and cried about a child dying. Frarich teamed up with another researcher at NCI called Tom Fry. Together, they became convinced that the problem was a lack of platelets, the irregularly shaped cell fragments that float around in human blood. The leukemia was destroying the children's ability to make them, and without platelets, their blood couldn't clot. This was a radical idea. One of Frarek's bosses at the NCI, a world expert in the field of hematology named George Brescher, was skeptical. But Frarek thought Brescher wasn't counting the platelets correctly when he did his analysis. Frarek was meticulous. He used a more sophisticated methodology and zeroed in on subtle changes in the platelets at really low levels, and to him, the connection was clear. The lower the platelet count, the worse the bleeding. The children needed fresh platelets, over and over again, in massive doses. The NCI blood bank wouldn't give Frarek fresh blood for his transfusions. It was against regulations. Frarek pounded on the table with his fists, shouting out, "You're gonna kill people!" "You have to be careful who you say that kind of thing to," Dick Silver, who worked at NCI with the Frarek, says. Jay didn't care. Frarek went out and recruited blood donors. The father of one of his patients was a minister, and he brought in 20 members of his congregation. Standard procedure in blood transfusions in the mid-1950s was steel needles, rubber tubes, and glass bottles. But it turned out that platelets stuck to those surfaces. So Frarek had the idea of switching to the brand new technology of silicone needles and plastic bags. The bags were called sausages. They were enormous. "They were this big," said Vince DeVita, who was one of Frarek's medical fellows in those years. He held his hands far apart. "And you have this kid who is only this big." He held his hands much closer together. It was like watering a flower pot with a fire hose. "If you don't do it right, you put the kids into heart failure." The clinical director of NCI at the time was a guy named Berlin. He saw the sausage and he said to Jay, "You're insane." He told Jay he was going to fire him if he kept doing platelet transfusions. Frarek ignored him. Jay being Jay, DeVita went on, he decided if he couldn't do it, he didn't want to work there anyway. The bleeding stopped. 7. Where did Frarek's courage come from? He's such an imposing and intimidating presence that it is easy to imagine him emerging from his mother's womb, fists already clenched. But McCurdy's idea about near and remote misses suggests something quite different. That courage is something acquired. Take a look again at what McCurdy wrote about the experience of being in the London Blitz. "We are all of us not merely liable to fear. We are also prone to be afraid of being afraid, and the conquering of fear produces acceleration. When we have been afraid that we may panic in an air raid, and when it has happened, we have exhibited to others nothing but a calm exterior and we are now safe. The contrast between the previous apprehension and the present relief and feeling of security promotes a self-confidence that is the very father and mother of courage." Let's start with the first line. We are all of us not merely liable to fear. We are also prone to be afraid of being afraid. Because no one in England had been bombed before, Londoners assumed the experience would be terrifying. What frightened them was their prediction about how they would feel once the bombing started. Then German bombs dropped like hail for months and months, and millions of remote misses who had predicted they would be terrified of bombing came to understand that their fears were overblown. They were fine. And what happened then? The conquering of that fear produces acceleration, and the contrast between the previous apprehension and the present relief and feeling of security promotes a self-confidence that is the very father and mother of courage. Courage is not something that you already have that makes you brave when the tough times start. Courage is what you earn when you've been through the tough times and you discover that they aren't so tough after all. Do you see the catastrophic error that the Germans made? They bombed London because they thought that the trauma associated with the Blitz would destroy the courage of the British people. In fact, it did the opposite. It created a city of remote misses, who were more courageous than they had ever been before. The Germans would have been better off not bombing London at all. The next chapter of David and Goliath is about the American Civil Rights Movement, when Martin Luther King Jr. brought his campaign to Birmingham, Alabama. There is one part of the Birmingham story that is worth touching on now, though, because it is a perfect example of this idea of acquired courage. One of King's most important allies in Birmingham was a black Baptist preacher named Fred Shuttlesworth, who had been leading the fight against racial segregation in the city for years. On Christmas morning in 1956, Shuttlesworth announced that he was going to ride the city's segregated buses in defiance of the city's laws forbidding blacks from traveling with whites. The day before the protest, on Christmas night, his house was bombed by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The Klan was trying to do to Shuttlesworth what the Nazis were trying to do to the English during the Blitz. But they, too, misunderstood the difference between a near and a remote miss. In Diane McWhorter's magnificent history of the Civil Rights Campaign in Birmingham, Carry Me Home, she describes what happened as the police and neighbors came running towards the smoking ruins of Shuttlesworth's house. It was late at night. Shuttlesworth had been lying in bed. They feared he was dead. A voice rose from the wreckage. "I'm not coming out naked." And after a few moments, Shuttlesworth emerged in a raincoat someone threw into the parsonage's rubble. He was not crippled, not bloodied, or blind. He was not even deaf, though the blast had blown windows out of houses a mile away. Shuttlesworth raised a biblical hand to the concerned neighbors and said, "The Lord has protected me. I am not injured." A big cop was crying. "Reverend, I know these people," he said to the bombers. "I didn't think they would go this far. If I were you, I'd get out of town. These people are vicious." "Well, officer, you're not me," Shuttlesworth said. "Go back and tell your Klan brothers that if the Lord saved me from this, I'm here for the duration. The fight is just beginning." That's a classic remote miss. Shuttlesworth wasn't killed, a direct hit. He wasn't maimed or badly injured, a near miss. He was unscathed. Whatever the Klan had hoped to accomplish had gone badly awry. Shuttlesworth was now less afraid than he had been before. The next morning, members of his congregation pleaded with him to call off the protest. He refused. McWhorter continues, "Hell yeah, we're going to ride," the cussing preacher said and addressed his board. "Find you any kind of crack you can hide in if you're scared, but I'm walking downtown after this meeting and getting on the bus. I'm not going to look back to see who's following me." His voice deepened into the preacher register. "Boys, step back," he ordered. "Men, step forward." A few months later, Shuttlesworth decided to personally take his daughter to enroll at the all-white John Herbert Phillips High School. As he drove up, a crowd of angry white men gathered around his car. Here is McWhorter again. To the child's disbelief, her father stepped out of the car. The men lunged at Shuttlesworth, bearing brass knuckles, wooden clubs, and chains. Scampering west across the sidewalk, he was repeatedly knocked down. Someone had pulled his coat up over his head so that he couldn't lower his arms. "We've got this son of a bitch now," a man yelled. "Let's kill him," the crowd screamed. From a white female cheering section came advice to "kill the motherfucking nigger and it will be all over." Men began smashing the windows of his car. So what happened to Shuttlesworth? Not much. He managed to crawl back into the car. He went to the hospital and was found to have minor kidney damage and some scratches and bruises. He checked himself out that afternoon, and that evening from the pulpit of his church, he told his congregation that he had only forgiveness for his attackers. Shuttlesworth must have been someone of great resolve and strength. But when he climbed unscathed out of the wreckage of his house, he added an extra layer of psychological armor. We are all of us not merely liable to fear, we are also prone to be afraid of being afraid. And the conquering of fear produces exhilaration. The contrast between the previous apprehension and the present relief and feeling of security promotes a self-confidence that is the very father and mother of courage. And then what happened at Phillips High School? Another remote miss. Upon leaving the hospital, Shuttlesworth told reporters Today is the second time within a year that a miracle has spared my life. If one remote miss brings exhilaration, we can only imagine what two bring. Not long afterward, Shuttlesworth brought a colleague, Jim Farmer, to meet with Martin Luther King at a church in Montgomery, Alabama. Outside, an angry mob had gathered, waving Confederate flags. They began to rock the car. The driver reversed and tried an alternate route, only to be blocked once more. What did Shuttlesworth do? Just like at Phillips High School, he got out of the car. Here again is McWhorter. Coke bottles shattered car windows around him as he paused to register a strange smell, his first whiff of tear gas. Then he beckoned Farmer out of the car and strode into the mob. Farmer followed, scared as hell, trying to shrink his bon vivant's ample body into Shuttlesworth's thin shadow. The goons parted. Their clubs went slack, and Shuttlesworth walked up to the doors of First Baptist without a thread on his jacket disturbed. "Out of the way," was all he said. "Go on. Out of the way." That's three remote misses. Losing a parent is not like having your house bombed or being set upon by a crazed mob. It's worse. It's not over in one terrible moment, and the injuries do not heal as quickly as a bruise or a scar. But what happens to children whose worst fear is realized, and then they discover that they are still standing? Couldn't they also gain what Shuttlesworth and the Blitz remote misses gained? A self-confidence that is the very father and mother of courage? The officer who took Shuttlesworth to jail, McWhorter writes of another of Shuttlesworth's many run-ins with white authority, struck him, kicked him in the shin, called him a monkey, and then goaded him. "Why don't you hit me?" Shuttlesworth replied, "Because I love you." He folded his arms and smiled the rest of the way to jail, where, forbidden to sing or pray, he took a nap. 8. The work that Frerich had done in stopping the bleeding was a breakthrough. It meant that children could now be kept alive long enough that the underlying cause of their illness could be treated. But leukemia was an even harder problem. Only a handful of drugs were known to be of any use at all against the disease. There was something called 6-MP and a standard anti-cancer drug called methotrexate and a steroid called prednisone. But each had the same limitation. They were essentially poisons, so toxic that they could be given in limited doses only. And because they could be given in limited doses only, they could wipe out only some of the children's cancer cells. The patient would get better for a week or so. Then the cells that survived would start to multiply, and the cancer would come roaring back. One of the consultants at the clinical center was a man named Max Wintrob, Frerich said. He was world famous because he wrote the first textbook of hematology, and he had written a review of the current state of the treatment of leukemia in children. I have a quotation from him that I show my students to this day. It says, "These drugs cause more harm than good because they just prolong the agony. The patients all die anyway. The drugs make them worse, so you shouldn't use them." This was the world's authority. But Fry and Frerich and a companion group at the Roswell Park Memorial Institute in Buffalo, led by James Holland, became convinced that the medical orthodoxy had it backwards. If the drugs weren't killing enough cancer cells, didn't that mean that the children needed more aggressive treatment, not less? Why not combine 6-MP and methotrexate? They each attacked cancer cells in different ways. They were like the Army and the Navy. Maybe the cells that survived 6-MP would be killed by methotrexate. And what if they added prednisone into the mix? It could be the Air Force, bombing from the air while the other drugs attacked from the land and sea. Then Frerich stumbled across a fourth drug, one derived from the periwinkle plant. It was called vincristine. Someone from the drug company Eli Lilly brought it by the National Cancer Institute for researchers to study. No one knew much about it, but Frerich had a hunch that it might work against leukemia. I had 25 kids dying, he said. I had nothing to offer them. My feeling was, I'll try it. Why not? They're going to die anyway. Then Christine showed promise. Freirich and Fry tried it out on children who no longer responded to the other drugs, and several went into temporary remission. So Fry and Freirich went to the NCI's Research Oversight Board to ask for permission to test all four drugs together. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. Cancer is now routinely treated with drug cocktails, complicated combinations of two and three and even four or five medications simultaneously. But in the early 1960s, it was unheard of. The drugs available to treat cancer in those years were considered just too dangerous. Even vincristine, Freirich's prized new discovery, was utterly terrifying. Freirich learned that the hard way. Did it have side effects? You bet, he says. It caused serious depression, neuropathies. The kids got paralyzed. When you get a toxic dose, you end up in a coma. Of the first 14 children we treated, one or two actually died. Their brains were totally fried. Max Wintrob thought the humane approach was not to use any drugs at all. Freirich and Fry wanted to use four all at once. Fry went before the NCI advisory board to ask for approval. He got nowhere. There was a senior hematologist on the board by the name of Dr. Carl Moore, who happened to be a friend of my father's from St. Louis, Fry remembered years later. I had always considered him a friend, too, but my presentation struck him as being outrageous. He didn't deal in pediatric diseases like childhood leukemia, so he talked about Hodgkin's disease in adults. He said that if you have a patient who has widespread Hodgkin's disease, then it's best to tell that patient to go to Florida and enjoy life. If patients are having too many symptoms from their Hodgkin's disease, you treat them with a little X-ray or possibly a little nitrogen mustard, but give them the smallest dose possible. Anything more aggressive than that is unethical, and giving four drugs at a time is unconscionable. Fry and Freirich were desperate. They went to their boss, Gordon Zubrod. Zubrod had been through the wars with Freirich over the platelets controversy. He had only reluctantly approved the vincristine experiment. He was responsible for what happened on the second floor. If somehow things didn't go well, he would be the one hauled before a congressional committee. Can you imagine? Two renegade researchers are giving experimental cocktails of highly toxic drugs to 4- and 5-year-olds at a government laboratory. He had grave reservations. But Fry and Freirich persisted. Actually, Fry persisted. Freirich isn't the kind of person who could be trusted with a delicate negotiation. I couldn't have done anything without Tom, Freirich admits. Fry is the inverse of me. He is deliberate and very humane. Yes, the drugs were all poisons, Fry argued, but they were poisonous in different ways, which meant that if you were careful with the dosages and if you were aggressive enough in the way you treated the side effects, the children could be kept alive. Zubrod gave in. It was crazy, Freirich said, but smart and correct. I thought about it and I knew it would work. It was like the platelets. It had to work. The trial was called the VAMP regimen. Some of the clinical associates, the junior doctors assisting on the ward, refused to take part. They thought Freirich was insane. I had to do it all myself, Freirich said. I had to order the drugs. I had to mix them. I had to inject them. I had to do the blood counts. I had to measure the bleeding. I had to do the bone marrows. I had to count the slides. There were 13 children in the initial round of the trial. The first was a young girl. Freirich started her off with a dose that turned out to be too high and she almost died. He sat with her for hours. He kept her going with antibiotics and respirators. She pulled through, only to die later when her cancer returned. But Fry and Freirich were learning. They tinkered with the protocol and moved on to patient number two. Her name was Janice. She recovered, as did the next child, and the next child. It was a start. The only problem was that the cancer wasn't gone. A handful of malignant cells was still lurking. One bout of chemotherapy wouldn't be enough, they realized. So they started up another round. Would the disease return? It did. They needed to try again. We gave them three treatments, Frarek said. 12 of the 13 relapsed, so I decided there's only one way to do this. We're going to continue treating them every month for a year. If people thought I was crazy before, now they thought I was completely crazy, Frarek went on. These were children who seemed completely normal, in complete remission, walking around, playing football, and I was going to put them in a hospital again and make them sick again. No platelets, no white cells, hemorrhage, infection. Vamp wiped out the children's immune system. They were defenseless. For their parents, it was agony. In order to have a chance at life, they were told, their child had to be brought savagely and repeatedly to the brink of death. Frarek threw himself into the task, using every ounce of his energy and audacity to keep his patients alive. In those days, when a patient developed a fever, the physician took a blood culture, and when the result came back, the doctor matched the infection with the most appropriate antibiotic. Antibiotics were never given in combination. You gave a second antibiotic only when the first one stopped working. One of the first things Jay said to us was, "No deal," DeVita remembers. "These kids spike a fever, you treat them immediately, and you treat them with combinations of antibiotics, because they're going to be dead in 3 hours if you don't." DeVita had an antibiotic that explicitly stated that it should never be administered in a spinal fluid. Frarek told him to give it to the patient in the spinal fluid. Frarek told us to do things, DeVita said, that we had been taught were heretical. He was subject to so much criticism, DeVita continued. The clinical associates thought that what he was doing was completely nuts. He carried the weight of it. They would insult him, especially the guys from Harvard. They used to stand in the back of the room and heckle. He would say something and they would say, "Sure, Jay, and I'm going to fly to the moon." It was awful, and Jay was there all the time, hovering over you, looking at every lab test, going over every chart. God help you if you didn't do something for one of his patients. He was ferocious. He would do things and say things that got him into trouble, or go to some meeting and insult someone, and Fry would have to come in and smooth things over. Did he care what people thought of him? Maybe, but not enough to stop doing what he thought was right. "How Jay did it," he said finally, "I don't know." But we do know, don't we? He'd been through worse. In 1965, Frarek and Fry published Progress and Perspectives in the Chemotherapy of Acute Leukemia in Advances in Chemotherapy, announcing that they had developed a successful treatment for childhood leukemia. Today, the cure rate for this form of cancer is more than 90%. The number of children whose lives have been saved by the efforts of Frarek and the researchers who followed in his footsteps numbers in the many, many thousands. 9. Does this mean that Frarek should be glad he had the childhood he had? The answer is plainly no. What he went through as a child, no child should ever have to endure. Along the same lines, I asked every dyslexic I interviewed the question posed at the beginning of the previous chapter. Would they wish dyslexia on their own children? Every one of them said no. Grazer shuddered at the thought. Gary Cohn was horrified. David Boies has two boys who are both dyslexic, and watching them grow up in an environment where reading early and well counted for everything nearly broke his heart. Here were one of the top producers in Hollywood, one of the most powerful bankers on Wall Street, and one of the best trial lawyers in the country, all of whom recognized how central their dyslexia was to their success. Yet, they also knew firsthand what the price of that success was, and they could not bring themselves to wish that same experience on their own children. But the question of what any of us would wish on our children is the wrong question, isn't it? The right question is whether we as a society need people who have emerged from some kind of trauma, and the answer is that we plainly do. This is not a pleasant fact to contemplate. For every remote miss who becomes stronger, there are countless near misses who are crushed by what they have been through. There are times and places, however, when all of us depend on people who have been hardened by their experiences. Freirich had the courage to think the unthinkable. He experimented on children. He took them through pain no human being should ever have to go through. And he did it in no small part because he understood from his own childhood experience that it is possible to emerge from even the darkest hell, healed and restored. Leukemia was a direct hit. He turned it into a remote miss. At one point in the midst of his battle, Freirich realized that the standard method of monitoring the children's cancer, taking a blood sample and counting the number of cancer cells under a microscope, wasn't good enough. Blood was misleading. A child's blood could look cancer-free, but the disease could still be lurking in her bone marrow, which meant that you had to go through the painful process of gathering bone marrow samples over and over again, month after month, until you were sure the cancer was gone. Max Wintrobe heard what Freirich was up to and tried to stop him. Freirich was torturing the patients, Wintrobe said. He was not wrong. His was the empathetic response. But it is also the response that would never have led to a cure. We used to do bone marrows by grabbing their legs like this, Freirich told me. He held one of his giant hands out, as if wrapped around a child's tiny femur. We'd stick the needle in without anesthesia. Why no anesthesia? Because they'd scream just as much when you gave them an anesthesia shot. It's an 18 or 19 gauge needle straight into the shin bone, right below the knee. The kids are hysterical. The parents and nurses hold the kid down. We did that for every cycle. We needed to know if their bone marrow had recovered. When he said the words, grabbing their legs like this, an involuntary grimace passed across Freirich's face, as if for a moment he could feel what an 18-gauge needle straight into the shin bone of a small child felt like, and as if the feeling of that pain would give him pause. But then, as quickly as it appeared, it was gone. 10. When Jay Freirich was doing his medical training, he met a nurse named Haroldine Cunningham. He asked her out on a date. She said no. All the young doctors were pretty aggressive, she remembers. He had a reputation for being very outspoken. He called a couple of times and I didn't go. But one weekend, Cunningham went to visit her aunt in a suburb outside of Chicago, and the phone rang. It was Freirich. He had taken the train out from Chicago and was calling from the train station. He said, "I'm here," she remembers. He was very persistent. This was the early 1950s. They had been married ever since. Freirich's wife is as small as Freirich is enormous, a tiny woman with a deep and obvious reservoir of strength. "I see the man. I see his needs," she said. He would come home from the hospital late at night, from the blood and the suffering, and she would be there. "She is the first person who ever loved me," Freirich says simply. "She is my angel from heaven. She found me. I think she detected something in me that could be nourished. I defer to her in all things. She keeps me going every day." Haroldine grew up poor as well. Her family lived in a tiny apartment outside Chicago. When she was 12, she tried the bathroom door and couldn't get in. "My mother had locked the door," she said. "I got the neighbor from downstairs, who was the landlord. He opened the window and got in. We called the hospital. She died there." You don't really know when you're 12 or 13 years old what is going on, but I knew she was unhappy. My father was away, of course. He was not a terrific father. She sat in the chair in her husband's office, this woman who carved an island of calm out of the turbulence of her husband's life. You have to realize, of course, that love doesn't always save people you want to save. Someone asked me once, "Weren't you angry?" And I said, "No, I wasn't." I understood her misery. There are things that either build you up or put you down. Jay and I have that in common.